This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We do more varieties and flavors of cheese than anywhere else on Earth. By pushing the boundaries of what cheese can and should be, find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and today we're going to talk about the chicken industry with one of my very favorite guests, Amanda Hitt, who is the director for the Food Integrity Campaign at the Government Accountability Project. Amanda, you and I met, I'm thinking it's got to be 10 years, when Timothy Patcherat mentioned you to me because of his book, Every 12 Seconds, which was kind of the beginning of my meat odyssey, if you will. And you have been coming on the show ever since. It's just amazing to me. It's been such a long time. So cool.
It's so good to be back too. I have a friend of mine who also appeared on your show, and she said, you know, when you and Katie get together, she's like, two of you laughing the whole time. I said, I'd like to think there's a little more substance to these conversations.
Yeah, I'd like to think that. Who was that person?
I'll tell you when we're off the air, but it's a former guest. I think she's jealous of our rapport.
That could be. Anyway, so today we were going to talk, unfortunately, our other guest, Rudy Howell, who is a chicken farmer in Mississippi?
He's in North Carolina.
North Carolina. Okay. Unfortunately, Rudy was unable to join us, not because he didn't want to, but because he has connectivity issues. And when we talk about the Build Back Better plan being advanced by the Biden administration, it is absolutely directly connected to Mr. Howell's difficulty in getting onto the internet on a, you know, sort of consistent and regular way. I mean, that's just like right there, the broadband access. Got to make that happen, so that we can have people like Rudy Howell come on and talk about his experiences. So, but you're going to stand in for him, Amanda, right? Because you know everything. The Government Accountability Project and the Food Integrity Campaign, which you lead, have been actually hired by Rudy, correct?
We are his attorneys. That's correct. We are, for folks that are interested, so all our work the majority of our work is pro bono. And when it's not pro bono, we call it low bono, which is extremely low, well below market rates that we help folks out with. And that's not just a Food Integrity Campaign, but all Government Accountability Project.
Right. Amazing. You guys are an amazing organization. I actually urge people to go check out the website for the Government Accountability Project, because in addition to the work that Amanda oversees with the Food Integrity Campaign, there are many, many, many other campaigns all running simultaneously with a number of different attorneys who are trying to get basically industry to do the right thing and government to do the right thing. But so we're going to talk about Rudy Howell. And Rudy was a grower for the Purdue Chicken Company. What got him? Why did he contact you? What happened?
So just for clarity, so I've actually known Rudy for a while.
Okay.
His recent situation is just that, but for years now, Rudy has been sort of aware of this industry and that there was corruption and injustice at its core. And Rudy's was growing for Purdue for over 25 years, mm-hmm. actually, and very outstanding, ranking, great, grower, of the year kind of guy, just an outstanding company man. And after a while of working in the industry, and he started to realize that there were some things that maybe weren't written down as clearly as they could have been, or maybe even in fact, he might have been persuaded into this industry not knowing the full scope and just how difficult and it is to be successful in this industry. And I should, for the listeners, I know we've talked about poultry before, but it's a good thing for, people who are new to this conversation. In contract growing, I guess the best way of explaining what happens with a poultry farmer, it's they're sort of like, chicken daycare for these giant corporations, right?
Right.
So the farmers own the buildings, they pay the electric bills, and they carry all the debt. And then these companies come in and grow, that's where the term growers comes from, grow the birds inside the farmers' facilities.
Right.
In essence, basically, the companies own the profit, the farmers own the debt. And they engage in these contracts that are without question, or they're what we call contracts of adhesion, or one-sided contracts, or take it or leave it contracts. Mm. These companies come into these rural communities and sell these farmers this whole idea of wealth and generative, generative wealth and keeping your family farm and feeding the world. And in reality, it's a little more than a scam.
So in fact, what happens is, as you mentioned, the company owns all the birds. They own all the profit. The farmer, let's also hasten to add, not only does he own the debt for maintaining his buildings and upgrading them, which they are frequently required to do, but they also own all the dead birds and they own all of the manure. And that may seem like, not that big a deal, but when you have 10 or 15 or 20,000 animals aggregated, or even 5,000 animals aggregated in one place, trust me, there is a lot of waste product. And that is a very difficult problem, which I think characterizes all of the animal agriculture in this country, but it is especially a problem for poultry and pork. So anyway,
yeah, that's actually a great jump then for me. So it was that increased mortality that brought Rudy. He and his other fellow growers were basically getting, non-surviving birds. I mean, too weak or too small to thrive. And so the term that's used, and it's a harsh term, but it is the term of art, is culling, right? Which is if a bird is not able to thrive, it is incumbent upon the farmer to cull or
euthanize
that baby chick. Mm-hmm. And it was exactly that. It was that activity that the mass culling that brought Rudy, who was already a critic of the system, to allow a video crew into his facility to sort of show firsthand what's really going on with these birds, their health, their welfare. And at that time, he'd made disclosures about even in his case, unsanitary conditions and things that he believed would ultimately threaten the food supply. So it was with those disclosures when those disclosures were made and those videos were published very shortly thereafter, after 27 years of being an outstanding and outstanding grower for the company. Sadly, Rudy's contract was terminated. And that's where we entered in Food Integrity Campaign and Government Accountability Project entered mm-hmm. in, and as more than just a, concerned group, an advocacy group, but now as Rudy's counsel.
Right. Now, when he talked, to back up a little bit, when you talk, he was demonstrating that there were unsanitary conditions, which presumably he would have some control over. Was he saying, in essence, that the chicks that he was getting were already diseased or dirty or otherwise compromised, aside from being, say, weak, and that he was concerned because he was being given birds that could potentially infect other flocks? Or explain a little, go into a little more depth about that.
Sure. So, obviously, there's the part about the birds being sort of a substandard quality and not able to thrive. So there's that. But when I was mentioning the sanitation, that is actually, his complaint was outside of his control. It's hard to imagine, but these birds are only alive for, a little over a month. And we're like six weeks of age. And at the end of their grow out, when they're about 5 pounds in Rudy's case, they come with machines that are called catch machines. Again, it's hard to, if you haven't seen something like this, the best way to describe it is a chicken vacuum.
Okay.
That comes into Rudy, would come into Rudy's barns and suck up the chickens, right?
Jeez.
It's like it's how it's done, at least in Rudy's case. Or they come in with catch crews and they you know, pick up, get the birds that are ready to go to market, right?
Yeah.
Well, in Rudy's case, he was finding that the machinery that was being used at someone else's farm was contaminated with dead birds in there, right?
Actually, oh.
Yeah. So somebody else's sick chicken stuff is basically coming over to Rudy's farm, and they're using this dirty equipment.
Okay.
And the transportation itself was compromised. Mm-hmm. And Rudy felt that it was unsanitary and unsafe, not only for his flock, but ultimately for the end consumer, which is where you have to understand none of these things just sort of, this all starts at the hatchery. I mean, this is a full chain of potential areas for problems. And Rudy just caught this one, and he had made his complaints known several times. But, you know, the question is, well, what did the company do about it? Nothing, which is unfortunately the nature of this system. Rudy made his complaints just like most whistleblowers. Actually, more than 80% of whistleblowers, they don't go right to the news. They don't go to the media. They don't go to lawyers. They don't go to Congress. Mm-hmm. They go to their boss and say, hey, there's something wrong. You need to fix it. Let's mm-hmm. make this system better. And that's exactly mm-hmm. what Rudy did. And it fell on deaf ears. He went to the USDA. He did everything right. And still nothing was done to correct this and other issues too. But this one was the one that Rudy talks about in his complaint. Especially in this day and age where we're so afraid of zoonotic disease and transfer and global pandemics. I mean, that's mm-hmm. all on everybody's mind.
Sure.
It's not the time for a company to be playing fast and loose with their transportation.
Absolutely.
So, you know, Rudy spoke out, which is his nature. I do wish he was here because he's about as straight shooter as they get.
Right.
So, you know, and he doesn't mince words. And if he's got problems, you know, he wants it fixed because, you know, his kids eat this food too. And sure. he wants a safe food supply.
Right. Right. So, the response from Purdue was no response. In other
no
words,
response.
Tough noogies. Mm-hmm. And then, the next response was, oh, well, if you don't like it, you're done. We're terminating your contract. You're not getting any more flocks from us. And let us hasten to add that I am going to opine here that there are no other integrators within, you know, sort of an appropriate distance for Rudy to then go to, say, another company like Tyson or Sanderson and say, hey, I'm not working with Purdue anymore. Can I get a contract with you? That is not an option. And in fact, he probably would have been blackballed no matter what, correct?
There you go, right? It's not just like you can switch integrators, which is the name for the companies.
So right.
They're vertically integrated, right?
Right.
And it's also, you know, I think it's a good place because you have a thoughtful audience. And, I met a lot of people who probably listen to Heritage Radio at Farm Aid 2021 just a little while ago.
Uh-huh.
And they were like, well, why didn't, you know, Rudy was there. And they said, well, why don't you just grow your own chickens and take them to market? And I think that's a normal question that most people want answers to. And they're like, well, I buy from a local farmer, but I don't think people fully understand how consolidated our food system is currently.
Right.
What you've tapped in, there is no other game in town. Even if Rudy filled his barns with his own chickens and took immaculate care of them and treated them with the greatest care and love and made sure they were healthy and wholesome birds, he would have no place to slaughter them.
Right.
He couldn't bring them to market. And that's the nature of the consolidation and what the term is vertical integration.
That's right.
And in that model, and we've talked about this before, but the way I like to see, you know, they own it from chick to chicken nugget. So every part of the process is actually owned by this integrator, hence the term integrator, right?
Vertical. That's right. That's right. That's right. So now he did something very radical, which was that he basically created I don't even know how to describe what he did in his fields. but he essentially plowed a message that could be read from the sky that was fair, hashtag fair shake for farmers.
That's
you
right.
Know, what, you know, just tell people a little bit about that because that's like so rad. I mean,
okay, so
wow.
this is not, hashtag fair shake was not Rudy's first thing he wanted to tell Purdue when they gave him his walking papers. I'll tell you that. He has his first reaction is Purdue has this campaign and it's called Not Too Chicken to Change. And Rudy said, you know, I should just go out in my grass, he grows grass, grass field and mow in the words too chicken to change, which would have been a powerful statement to Purdue. But what he did instead was put this hashtag fair shake into his field. Each letter was 90 feet tall.
Wow.
And the entire thing was just a shy of 900 feet long. So this is no small feat that he mowed into this grass field, this hashtag. And what he'd done by doing that is joined his story with, you know, in total over 56 different groups had all joined to send a message to Congress and to the USDA and anyone who was going to listen that the current state of play is unacceptable and that there is a huge imbalance of power between farmer producers like Rudy and these giant corporations. And so Fair Shake became sort of our rallying cry for 1 week. Where we built up the dialogue and the sort of just awareness around consolidation in all parts of agriculture. But Rudy's story featured prominently. We were able to do a really beautiful video. It's very powerful and very moving where Rudy tells his story. And and you see the end result is this hashtag Fair Shake. So his story was among many other stories of farmers who have essentially been left, bankrupt by these corporations and their extractive ways.
Yes.
And also, you know, you have to remember, too, the environment suffers for this. And in Rudy's case, the animals do. And also, you know, the communities around these farms. I mean, it basically, you know, they reduce these rural communities into, you know, ghost towns and bankrupting the farmers and undermining any chance for, regrowth and success and, building into these communities. It's a terrible problem. It's our problem as eaters.
Right.
It's not limited to just rural communities. We cannot sustain this. And is that time for change. And, if Rudy was here for as long as he's been fighting this fight, I think he would and he'd want me to tell you all and tell your listeners this, he does think that now is that time. Like, I really do think we're there, Katie. I think this is a tipping point, and I think that COVID really exposed how fragile this hyper-consolidation has made our food system.
Yeah.
And I believe that we are right on the precipice of something really big, some really great changes in the food system.
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, if you have an old dinosaur like Chuck Grassley talking about, you know, breaking up the monopolies, there might be some chance of change because basically this has all been allowed to snowball along over the course of the last 4 or 5 decades because of the willingness of Congress to turn a blind eye to the egregious excesses of these large, especially animal agricultural companies, really have to be stopped, basically. So tell us a little bit, Amanda, how is the Food Integrity Campaign working with Rudy to rectify his situation? Like, what do you anticipate happening in light of the disclosures that he's made, in light of whatever type of litigation he is engaged in? What's going on from your point of view in terms of what you're going to be offering him as a remedy?
So at this point, we did file a complaint. So we are in the process. You know, we'll have to see where things go. And I think that's probably about as much as I can say about the actual litigation itself is that it's in play, that we are that has been started. We intend to remain and stay with Rudy until we successfully get this fixed, not just for him but hopefully for other farmers. I think that I think I'm saying, oh, it looks good. You know, outlook looks better. You know, we've seemed to have an incredible amount of support coming out of the White House for ending consolidation. You know, the ball is in these integrators' courts, right? I mean, they either start playing ball and start working with their farmers and producers, or they're going to, this isn't going to end because while Rudy might be unique in that he's spoken up, he is certainly not alone in what he has endured as a farmer.
Right,
and producer.
Right.
I promise you that there are many, many more. I think we'll probably get to that many, many more observation, you know, further along in today's discussion. But Rudy is certainly not alone. And if you look at, you know, and I don't want to get too far ahead, but if you look at some of the reforms that are in the works, one of them, and maybe chief among them, is to demand that these companies stop this retaliation against America's farmers.
Yeah.
They've gone through enough, you know. You either start listening, but which is to your own benefit, or you're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to make amends for a lot of years of being a bully, right?
Yeah.
And you know, we do hope to level that playing field and shift that balance.
Well, a guy like Rudy, does he want to be reinstated? I mean, I would be kind of done with the business. But is that even possible for him?
I don't think it's possible as far as Purdue is concerned. I think, but you know, I mean, obviously that, I mean, Rudy didn't set out to become a whistleblower. He's not a rebel.
Right.
He's just a guy that, you know, observed enough wrongdoing and was left unheard and unheeded for long enough that he chose alternative means to speak out.
Yeah,
because that's where he was going to be heard. And that's why I'm here today. It's because he had to go outside of the system. So, no, I mean, I don't think nobody I've ever met anyway has wanted to do anything but improve the system, not to destroy it and take it out.
Mm-hmm.
I believe over time, however, that there are folks who used to be part of the system who once advocated for reform are now realizing that we just need a new system.
Yeah.
We can't undo the wrong that has occurred, nor can we correct the trajectory. We are not, I mean, anybody who witnessed the emptying of the shelves, right? So they were, again, using this word we talked about earlier, culling the chickens, culling the pigs on the farms. Meanwhile, the shelves were empty. There is a oblivion event happening in our food supply chain. And, you know, I'm not Pollyanna enough to think that all these legislators and voted in people suddenly had a change of heart and are now love Rudy Howell. I think they've had a great awakening, right?
Huh.
If we don't fix this, we're in a mess of trouble. I mean, that's understatement of the year.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. You know, it's interesting. Well, we'll see how much political will they have going forward. I mean, it's, luckily we have some elections coming up. Hopefully we'll be Democrats who win them because, you know, I can see business going back to business as usual with a Republican majority taking over in 2022, unfortunately. But maybe not. Let's take a short break here for a sponsor drop. We'll be right back with Amanda Hitt from the Government Accountability Project, the Food Integrity Campaign. And we're going to talk more about sort of how these companies keep farmers to heel, as it were. So stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin, the state of cheese, makes half of the nation's specialty cheese and wins more awards than any other state or country. Our heritage and traditions, master cheesemaker program, and the American propensity for innovation all put Wisconsin on the cutting wedge of cheesemaking. With over 600 varieties of cheese to choose from and 5,500 national and international awards and counting, get ready to turn your refrigerator into a trophy case. Enjoying a Wisconsin cheese is basically like winning a gold medal in culinary achievement. Set your mind at cheese. When you bite into a wedge of Wisconsin Wonderful, you know it is made with the ultimate skill and passion possible. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Okay. So we were talking about Rudy Howell, but let's talk about another group of farmers in Mississippi. And this is a very interesting issue right here because it directly relates to what you were talking about earlier in terms of consolidation and you know, basically consolidation and market manipulation ultimately. Mm-hmm. And that is the case of what has happened here is that a proposed merger with Sanderson Farms, which is one of the biggest, one of the big four chicken integrators, and Wayne Farms, who obviously less large, but still obviously very important in Mississippi. They, both of those companies, as I understand this, have been acquired by Cargill, Cargill being a major source of feed. See, this is people, you know, like this, here we're looking at vertical integration writ large because Cargill is a big grain producer, corn and soy especially. And that's what goes into feeding chickens. So it's not surprising that they would want to build those chicken companies into their model, right? So what happened with Sanderson Farms that prompted this coalition of farmers in Mississippi to band together to push back against the pay cuts that Sanderson Farms said were simply, you know, a function of market correction and nobody was going to lose money? Let's unpack that whole story because it's a bit complex.
It is complex, but I think the thing I would add to that is, you know, so Sanderson sort of approached it as, well, we're going to go to, you know, back to pre-COVID, you know, payouts, you know, or something along those lines. And that was just patently untrue. I mean, they announced the merger on day two, they announced they're, you know, cutting everybody's paycheck, all these farmers' right. paycheck. Now, I guess it could have just been strange sort of occurrence. I guess these things just sort of happen, or they could have been directly connected. But the farmers in Mississippi were having none of it, which I think is, remember I was saying earlier and before the break, I do think we're at a different point now.
Yeah.
And what I want to share with your listeners and with you is that the only thing that happened here is that it worked, right? It actually worked. So like, it's not that, and I, you know,
well,
I'm
normally speaking, farmers do not band together.
No, that's right? What it is.
We should make that point is that these guys are basically out there on their own. They're scared to speak up. They're afraid that what's happened to Rudy Howell and Craig Watts and all these other guys is going to happen to them. So normally they all keep their counsel unless they're particularly brave, and they certainly never get together to discuss these issues in a public forum. And that's what I agree with you. That's what makes this particular story so unusual. So I've interrupted you enough. Go on.
No, you know, but you know, again, it's one of those sort of teachable moments. They're not just cowardly men and women who don't right. want to speak up. Their system, their pay system, it actually pits them against each other right. where the highest performers get bonuses from their neighbors' low performance. So a low performer gets a pay cut and then the high performer gets a bonus from that cut. So the desire to speak to your neighbor is pretty much squashed, right? Because you don't helping your neighbor can invariably lead to you receiving less money.
Right.
So the system itself has evolved to really make it unadvisable in some ways to seek counsel outside of your own farm or to band together. And also, right. you know, there's this, you know, this aspect of whistleblowing. A lot of people, you know, really realize is we still in America, even if you're, you know, urban dweller, I mean, in America, there's still these company towns. They're company towns. I mean, people, that's how you make money in some of these rural communities is working for Sanderson.
Right.
So if you're going to go against the company, you're invariably going to put somebody, your neighbor out of work or somebody you go to church with. I mean, this isn't free market, right? These are captured people. To me, it's most analogous for, you know, anybody who, you know, follows labor and labor history. It's most analogous to the coal industry, in my opinion, where everybody knew how bad the mines were, but nobody could speak out against it, what little you had would be taken from you.
Yes.
So it's just not an option to organize. Also, you know, just protections that, you know, are generally there as a function of law for other sectors are not there for the ag folks. So again, there's obstacles to actual organizing. And mm-hmm. that goes into, and just very briefly touching on it, is that they are classified as independent contractors, not employees, which I firmly disagree about. I mean, it's just a BS thing, but nonetheless, they're independent contractors.
So no unionization, no protections of any kind that could be extended to a group.
Right, and I think you have to understand that. Because the impulse, of course, Katie, is to, you know, ask, you know, well, you know, why, if it's so bad, why did you stay? It's so bad, you know, why did you stay? One should change his or her, you know, question here. Say, instead of saying, well, if it's so bad, why did you stay? You have to start wondering, what power and force could there be there that kept you there, right? That's the question. It isn't what made you stay, blame the victim. It's like, what level of power and authority are we dealing with here that makes it impossible for farmers to get out of the system or effectively and safely speak out against it?
Right. Let's talk for a minute about the Packers and Stockyards Act. Because suddenly that has been revived as a tool with which to roll some of that power that you're talking about back so that farmers get that quote unquote fair shake. And Vilsack, who had an opportunity to work on the Packers and Stockyards Act during the Obama administration, ultimately did nothing. How committed do you think this administration is? How committed will Tom Vilsack be as an advocate for especially animal agriculture, farmers and producers? And what kind of reforms are they talking about that would have an impact on these guys?
Yeah, I guess just to clarify. So I would classify what Vilsack failed to do is that he did do something that was too little too late. That would be the category that I would put that in. It certainly was not for a lack of knowledge of the situation or concern about it, but the rollout just with, you know, to give farmers an effective Bill of Rights through the Packers and Stockyards Act just didn't happen in time. And then Trump came in and, you know, and then he comes up with this new rulemaking that basically memorializes all the bad things that we as advocates were trying to change. Mm-hmm. So here we are again, Vilsack, you know, version 2.0. And the question is, well, what's happened? I go back to, you know, I really think that the biggest change has been the sort of awakening to the fragility of the food system.
Yes.
That requires immediate governmental intervention. Whereas before it was, you know, recognizing, you know, corporate power, its impacts on rural communities, things that naturally the USDA should concern itself with. But now we're actually looking at the pockets, right? We're looking at money here. And I don't know if you know this, but in DC, it seems like the money things do get the attention they deserve. Maybe I'm jaded having been around for a while. But
maybe,
there's the laughing. they do. Like this is going to impact the companies as well. Their avarice, their pursuit of profit at all cost. They're you know, we've been dealing with giant bellies, and we need to start talking to brains and hearts now.
Yeah.
The stomachs are full. They're about to rupture. So we better do something about it. I think Vilsack's impetus to change is to preserve the United States agriculture sector. And that means ultimately, you know, using the reforms that are available to the USDA in other mechanisms, but most maybe clearly in my case, the Packers and Stockyards Act, which is kind of an obscure piece of you know, legislation. And a lot of people don't know about it, but this is not a new fight either, Katie. I mean, this is like decades of fighting this fight too. So everything old is new again, except for this one's polished off and maybe get the attention it deserves.
I hope so. You know, I mean, just to kind of expand a little bit on what you just said, during the re-election for Obama's second term, I think it was. I went down to Congress and I was asking various congressional members, you know, what their stances were on agriculture. I had just interviewed Shelley Pingree from Maine, and she said, oh, go talk to Thomas Massey of Kentucky, because I'm sometimes able to work across the aisle with him. So I go to his office, and I, you know, people who've listened to me for a long time have heard this story many times, but it really speaks to what you're saying here. And I said, so, you know, the congressman comes in, and I said, oh, I'm wondering if you'd be interested in coming on my radio show to talk a little bit about the food system. And, you know, I think we were basically, I was referring to sort of animal agriculture, which has been kind of something I've followed for about 10 years now. And he looks at me and he says, there's nothing wrong with our food system. The food industry is doing a fantastic job of feeding people. And yeah. I obviously don't want to be on your radio program. And he turned on his heel and walked into his office and slammed the door. And I just thought to myself, well, you clearly don't understand what is happening. I think the reason he got mad, oh, I know. I said, oh, well, what if the food system is doing such a great job, why are there over 40 million food insecure people in this country? And he said, I don't want to be on your radio show. But, you know, it was just, it was his assumption. And I think this is, you know, very much a widespread belief throughout congressional representatives, both House of Representatives and Senators, is that, yeah, the food system has got it all under control. We don't need to do anything. They're fine. And, you know, it is only, as you just said, it is only when the supply chain weaknesses became apparent that we are now seeing this interest in Congress in reforming agriculture, and, you know, clearly not a moment too soon. But anyway, I want to just, I guess we should finish up fairly soon here. What, you know, if the companies are broken up in some way, say the Packers and Stockyards Act is updated and it starts to be enforced and various other mechanisms, you know, the Sherman Act and so on. I mean, all of these antitrust things that could be enforced and haven't been. What is the ultimate impact of that going to be, do you think, on farmers like Rudy Howell? How is that going to change things for the better for him?
I do this work and certainly representing the clients and so forth, but one of my big interest, and, you know, we didn't have a chance to talk about this, is, you know, imagining this new day where there is actual competition and that we're not faced with these Hobson's choices. You know what I mean? Where there is actually an opportunity for a rural farmer to produce anything other than food that is destined for the animal agriculture sector. And just again, you know, you said you were very interested in animal ag. That's because the food that we produce in the United States goes to animals. And I don't think a lot of people understand that. And, you know, there's not an because of crop insurance and checkoffs and there's so much consolidation, there really isn't something for someone to do who's outside of industrial agriculture. There aren't real opportunities. I mean, you might be able to do some cut flowers or, you know, do some, you know, farmers market stuff, but that's high risk, low return.
Yeah.
It's much easier if you've got a huge, you know, or got access to land to go and take out one of these loans and put a chicken barn on it, you know, and then you don't have, you know, you get sold the whole thing. You don't have the risks, you know, blah, blah, blah. We, you know, the food, blah, blah, blah. They get, it's more turnkey and it's more of a real option for people entering into agriculture to just, you know, assign yourself to the industrial ag model. You look at the, you know this, we've talked about this, but there's the schools of agriculture, the land grant colleges. Look at the names on the buildings.
Thank you.
There's like Prestige Farm School of Poultry. Like there's no like Joe Farmer School of how to raise a healthy chicken and, you know, sustain your community and feed the world at the same time. No, there's only one model for feeding the world. I suspect that that was Massey's point too. Like, hey, we're feeding the world. We're just not doing it well or in a way that's sustainable. So if we broke down these, so the question that long way here to get here, but here we are. If we broke these down, what if we actually could produce climate friendly crops? Like, so here's an example. So there's plants that are perennial crops, right? Mm-hmm. Which means you don't have to reseed them, put them in every year.
Right.
I mean, what if we actually had those? You imagine like the soil and the health of the environment or just, you know, weren't so into monoculture. Imagine what would happen if there was like a blight that affected soy or corn, be devastating.
Yeah.
With no diversification. And what little we have, you know, some people are like, oh, I have a local farmer. It's true you do, but the world does not have a local farmer. The world has nothing more than a serf who's very much a slave to an industrial model that they can't break free of because there's just no real choice. Right. I'd love to see different proteins out there. I'd love it. I mean, it's a personal interest of mine, but we've got a long way to go to change the minds of the people themselves, who are, quite frankly, very habituated to the oppressive sort of model that they work in. This is all they've known.
Yeah.
And they've been told that to go against this, remember we talked about the company town, is one thing, but to go against this is you know, personal, you know, professional suicide. You won't make it unless you're backed by the big guys. So yeah. We have to address that, and we have to build out local markets. And at least at the very least, we need to start building out a parallel system that operates locally, because the supply chains are just too fragile to sustain. It's not an opinion. Okay. Like this is what happens when you do, as you said, you know, 40 or 50 years of unchecked and unmitigated consolidation.
Yeah.
You find yourself at the wrong end of the gun, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But you know, I've always often thought that these industries are strangely, you know, sort of sociopathic anyway, and I think they would wield that gun around. I don't think they'd have any problems if they shot their own foot. Their pursuit of profit is paramount.
It is frightening. But I have to say, I feel a little bit of a glimmer of hope in that sense also, that the drive of profit, of money over everything else is starting to be a little bit drowned out by the exigencies of climate disruption, which really no one at this point can deny. And, you know, when push comes to shove, even the big players like Cargill or Archer Daniel Midland or any of these other monocropping, major industrial worldwide players are going to have a come to Jesus moment, if about nothing else, about water and water use. And, you know, that is where the rubber is going to meet the road, because we have got to start looking to the future in terms of preserving our water supplies, because they will not last without some serious attention and husbandry to preserve that. And that includes not planting water intensive crops, you know, in places where they don't belong. You know, you know, it's kind of, some of these remedies are really rather simple. But anyway, with that, Amanda, I'm afraid we must say goodbye to you for this particular iteration of this show. Thank you so much for being Rudy's voice, and thank you so much for the work you do with the Government Accountability Project and the Food Integrity Campaign. We all eat a little safer thanks to Amanda and her team. So we'll talk to you again very soon, I hope.
Thanks so much, Katie.
Oh, and by the way, your website, people, whistleblower.org, right?
So Government Accountability Project is whistleblower.org, but if you're interested in our food work, very simple, we're foodwhistleblower.org.
There you go. All right. Check it out, people. There's a lot of good information on there, including the excellent video that Amanda referenced at the top of the show, featuring Rudy Howell talking about his own situation. So do check it out. And thanks again, Amanda, for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next week, listeners. Take care. So long, everybody. What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.